connecting sleep to sports isn't easy, but here goes. Mattress Firm is America's neighborhood mattress store, and it should be your goal to check out the deals they have going on every day. Their mattresses are softer than your rival team's defense. They get a 10 out of tennis. You'll love your new bed. Okay, all terrible dad jokes aside, head to mattressfirm.com/podcast and stretch your budget further than a gymnast before a floor routine. It's Listener Appreciation Week. We are opening the giant mailbag and answering your questions. Is Wentz really an MVP candidate after his backup just won the Super Bowl? Now that Garoppolo is locked in, what do the 49ers need next? Is Sam Bradford still a viable option as a free agent? We'll talk about all that and so much more on the MMQB 10 Things podcast. Hello and welcome to the MMQB 10 Things podcast. I'm Gary Gramling. He is Andy Benoit, and this is the Reader Appreciation Mailbag Show. It's that time of year where we're transitioning to the offseason here. Not quite free agency time, not quite draft time, but I think it's time to sort of take the potpourri of questions here, Andy.
It's that time of the year where in the evenings I just lay down and watch a bunch of bullcrap on TV every single night. Actually, on Netflix. I don't watch TV anymore, and I love it. For about a week and a half, I can do it, and then I'm ready to actually do something productive again.
Yeah, it was it was an eventful week, and we're, you know, let's before we dive into the mailbag, let's talk real quick about Jimmy Garoppolo here. He got his extension, which was not surprising. I mean, we all knew the 49ers were going to retain him. Perhaps surprising that he did the old, and I'm going to steal a term that I like from Connor Orr of the MMQB. It's the old contractual Jenga with the agents, where you pull it out and you top the last one. That's what Garoppolo did here. He got the biggest contract as far as annual value in NFL history. I think it's fine. I think good for him. I wasn't sure he'd get that large a contract, but I don't really have a big problem with it. And you know, he certainly showed enough that you can be optimistic about him going forward.
Yeah, you know, remember, quarterbacks cost what they cost. You don't get a bargain on a quarterback very often, and if you try to get one, you can find yourself in a bit of a quagmire like the Redskins did eventually. Mm-hmm. You could say, hey, they should have just tagged Garoppolo. Five starts is not enough. Let's see if he can do it over the course of a season. I think that's a valid argument. I think the counter argument is also valid, which is, well, you tag him, but other contracts come up. Kirk Cousins comes up. Heaven forbid, maybe Aaron Rodgers gets a new deal. And heaven forbid for the Niners' standpoint, because now Garoppolo's more expensive to sign than next year. So let's do it now. It's going to be bad no matter what we do money-wise. It's only going to get worse. Sooner is better. We're going to take the gamble. I think both sides are valid, and I don't know if one's right or one is wrong. The Niners looked tremendous with Jimmy Garoppolo last year. He's not a rookie. Remember, he's been around for a while, but he is new to the scene. So we'll find out if it works. I don't have an issue with them. If you're going to take a chance, and this is definitely taking a chance, because again, five starts, but if you're going to do that, a potential star quarterback, that's the position you'd take the chance with.
Yeah, and you know, the other point I'd make is the 49ers have all this cap space, but they're not a team where they're going to be cutting a bunch of players. It's not like they have a bunch of guys they want to get rid of. They have a lot of young guys that they want to hang on to. You only have so many roster spots. So it's almost like, you know, this was kind of my criticism of the Browns a year ago. The space is just sitting there. I realize cash on hand is a different issue, but you got the cap space where if you front load this contract, and we don't know the details yet, but if you front load it, it makes all the sense in the world, because you're not going to be able to spend that money in free agency anyway, because you're not shopping for a quarterback. So it doesn't really matter as long as you have the cash to pay him.
Well, and it's not a great free agent class, even no matter what position you need. There's no team should be spending huge money in this free agency period, because there aren't four or five guys. There might be four or five guys worth huge money, so I guess if you get all of them, you're fine. But you know what I'm saying. It's not like this class goes two dozen deep like we've seen other free agent classes. Mm-hmm. So I would imagine a lot of teams don't plan on going heavy into free agency this year. They'll still sign guys. Guys will still get overpaid. But there's no one that moves the meter in this free agent class.
Yeah.
Other than maybe Kirk Cousins, of course. But that doesn't apply to San Francisco.
And, of course, we will be talking free agency down the line in a couple of shows here. But right now, as promised, let's open the mailbag. You know, keep on sending the questions in. We're not sure what the news cycle is going to do the next couple of weeks here. But I think we're going to have some room for mailbag questions, if not full-on mailbag shows. And as always, we started putting our contact info in the episode descriptions if you want to find it there. One of the listeners requested that. It's at @ggramling_si. @Andy_Benoit on Twitter. We're both on Facebook, or you can email talkback@themmqb.com. But let's get out of here. Got a couple of 49ers questions to start here. Very similar, so I'm actually going to group you guys together. This is Jonathan and Justin, both wrote into Talkback, essentially asking what is the 49ers' biggest position of need this offseason? Justin also added, you guys have talked about Shanahan's offense in the past. You've discussed how it uses a lot of movement and shifting to show if a team is in zone man coverage, system like that. Is it essential to have a stud receiver, or can they get by with a series of sort of, you know, decent guys like we've seen some teams do in the past? So Andy, with that in mind, what in your mind is the 49ers' biggest need on this roster?
Well, those questions probably overlap. I think you could say they need a wide receiver. For the team needs article in the magazine a few weeks ago, I identified offensive line as the biggest need, but there was a big caveat in my explanation, which is it's not a glaring need because of the nature of the system. The ball tends to be out pretty quickly in Shanahan's scheme. Garoppolo's a quick twitch guy, but if you're going to be spending this kind of money on your quarterback, you might as well protect him, and you can never have too many good offensive linemen. So I would say offensive line, but I think that question about the wide receiver and what's the expectation there and what's the demand in this system, I think that one's worth evaluating.
Well, what do you think, Andy? I mean, you know, they got a big year out of Marquise Goodwin last year. Garcon got hurt mid-season, but he was off to a pretty decent start. Do you think they're all right? Let's say they firm up the line and sort of go in with the same receivers as last year. Trent Taylor in the slot. They got a couple of tight ends. I mean, is that, you know, that might not light the world on fire, but is that kind of good enough for a Kyle Shanahan offense?
Probably not. You probably need a little bit more. George Kittle, to me, is the only really receiving threat they have at tight end. Garrett Sellick's a nice player, but you could be a little more dynamic at that position. They don't have the receiving back, although, who was it, Joe Williams that they drafted last year in the fourth round. They maybe feel he could be that guy. He was hurt all season as a rookie. And then wide receiver, Goodwin got a lot better under Garoppolo. I mean, it's like a night and day difference. And it wasn't just Goodwin being a track star, which he has literally been before, but it was him running a decent route tree and getting open. He's got great stop and start quickness, kind of like what Antonio Brown does. Not saying he's at that level, but stylistically, he can get fast and slow very quickly, and that's a huge trait to have. So I think he's a legitimate starter. I don't think he's got the body type you build around, though. I don't think he's your number one, so to speak.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure. Yeah, and I'm not sure Pierre Garçon is quite that either. So if you found a receiver you loved, go for it. But with Trent Taylor in the slot, who I think they do love him for what he is, and then Garcon and Goodwin outside, that's not horrible. That's average, and I think average it can be good enough as we look at this as a long-term project for the Niners. So really, Gary, my sense as we work our way through this, I think the Niners are in a position where they can draft the best offensive player available on the board, almost regardless of position, because everybody is replaceable on this roster, but there are no glaring holes on that side of the ball. And the defense is actually in not too bad a shape either.
Yeah, and I'd add on receivers just real briefly. Calvin Ridley is probably your best one in the draft. He's kind of a similar body type, similar style, probably a better player, but similar style to Marquise Goodwin. And as we said, there's no one in this free agent class who's really going to light the world on fire here. Jarvis Landry, if you're into him and want a slot guy. But yeah,
I don't think Shanahan would like Landry, by the way.
Yeah. As a player?
Yeah. I think he would want a more consistently disciplined and precise route runner and player. I think Landry's a great talent, but I can see Shanahan having frustrations there.
All right. Next question here, coming from Justin Gillies on Twitter, and he is we dropped the ball on this one, Andy. We never circled back and talked about this, probably because they played the Super Bowl, but backup quarterbacks at the podium at Super Bowl Media Day. Tom Brady and Drew Bledsoe were both there. That's what Justin pointed out. That was from an old Bill Simmons ESPN column. Correct me if I'm wrong, Andy. Wentz was at Media Day, but not at a podium, correct?
Correct. So what we were wondering, because Wentz is a bigger star than Foles, is would Wentz also have a podium at Media Day, on Media Night, on Monday before the Super Bowl? And I think 11 guys and maybe two coaches, something around there, 10 to 12 podiums overall exist. Three coaches. The Eagles had all their coordinators and then their head coach, of course. And so I was curious, would they give both a podium and who would draw more people? They did not give Wentz the podium, you're right. He was there for a little while, and he sat in the stands off to the side. And he did draw a decent crowd, but he was in a location. The crowd could only be so big because there wasn't room in the stands around him. Everyone had to line up on the stairs, the stadium steps, to get to him. So it was nice. I think he enjoyed himself there. But Foles got more attention, but they set it up that way. And yes, okay. I forgot all about. I remembered thinking about it, but we forgot to address it on the podcast. That guy's right.
Well, they play the game in the meantime, so I forgive us for that one. But
okay,
but yeah,
I do too.
That was a nice job by Justin to remind us though. Next
and then
question
to go
here,
find it. By the way, he's the nut job. We said we need a nut job who's going to go look up this stuff and figure it out. He's the
there
one who
go.
Did it.
Thank you, Justin. And also, yes, you are a nut job. This next one's coming from Michael Schutz on Twitter. A couple of these questions are kind of in the same vein, but we'll go through them one by one, even if we maybe repeat ourselves a little bit. Michael asks, for your mailbag, doesn't the Eagles win and Foles winning Super Bowl MVP weaken the argument that Wentz was an MVP candidate? He's a great quarterback, but they just won the Super Bowl without him. Can someone be an MVP on a team that can win it all without them? I think it's a good start to a conversation, a good start to a debate. Andy, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that, to be honest, and I think it is. I mean, it's this barroom kind of debate, but I think it's a good one. It's a smart barroom, maybe a little above that. And I'm surprised we haven't heard more of that. And I haven't been looking at Twitter a lot lately, so maybe people have been saying that. Have you heard this sentiment anywhere else besides this question, Gary?
Not really. I think especially
I didn't think about it.
MVP was obviously decided by the time the Super Bowl came around, so. I do my best to avoid Twitter, but yeah, it's Nick Foles probably isn't the second best player in the league, so you know it's a valid argument to make against Wentz for MVP. It's probably pretty lazy to say it this way, but I just think you almost have to just say the value of a quarterback is obviously going to be married to the coach and what the coach does with him and the system he's in, and you kind of just have to almost throw it out. Like, I don't necessarily know. I know there's one obvious example that everyone will throw out, but for the most part, I don't know if there's necessarily a quarterback who's great great despite a like bad coaching or a bad system or something like that.
Well, and keep in mind, the Eagles didn't win by playing to Nick Foles' style. They won by Nick Foles playing like Carson Wentz. Nick Foles got better down the stretch, and he played at a superstar level in the championship and the Super Bowl. That's two of their three playoff games. Before that, the Eagles looked lost at times. So I don't think this is a referendum on anyone, because Foles turned into Wentz rather than the offense being reduced and the Eagles finding new ways to win or other guys stepping up. Foles became what Wentz was. And if you want to have a different conversation, and there will be teams that do have this conversation, is do we believe Nick Foles can do that on a longer term basis? And we don't need to figure that out now, but that's the question for his whole career moving forward, for his immediate future anyway. But I don't think this changes Wentz. I think Wentz was legitimately – I still would have voted Brady 1 and Wentz 2 if things had stayed on track through week 12. But I think it was all legitimate. And I don't think whoever was number 3 was very close to those two guys in the MVP race this year.
Yeah. Next question. This is Eric via TalkBack. This is a hypothetical, and I doubt it had ever happened, but should the Eagles consider trading Carson Wentz? They have a 29-year-old Super Bowl MVP. Think about what they could get for Wentz, et cetera. How much could they get in return, and would it be better to get 3 or 4 high draft picks in this and next year's draft? It won't happen. This is a very hypothetical question. I don't know. If you were another team, how much would you give up? You have to give up, like, what, 4 or 5 number ones or something like that to get a guy who's, 20, what is Wentz now, 25, and he's basically proven as a surefire franchise quarterback at this point. I mean, it's like you can't put a price tag on that almost.
I agree. I think this would make no sense for either team doing it, because if you are to pull the trigger and make that trade, if you're going to acquire Wentz, you're right. I think it is probably four number ones, maybe some number two. I mean, it'd be a bounty like nothing we've ever seen. And you'd be doing that for a guy coming off, if we did it now, you'd be doing it for a guy coming off a knee injury, and that's enough to spook anyone. And if you're the Eagles, what's the point of having all those draft picks if when you finally get the one that's best of all, the superstar quarterback, you trade him away? Your draft picks are only as good as the players they turn into. And the Eagles got one of their picks to turn into Carson Wentz. They're probably not going to do better than that over the next 4 or 5 years. And it's harder to win without a quarterback than with a quarterback, even though I know the Eagles just did it. That was on a short-term basis. They won 2 games with Foles, well, 3 playoff games, but 2 games riding Foles. So I think it's – I get the question. I understand it. I don't think anyone would take that kind of plunge. That is a huge gamble with negative consequences for everyone – potentially for everyone involved.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, the obvious question for the Eagles at this point is what would it take to pry Nick Foles away for a team that might be interested, and that's something I'm sure we'll talk about all season. And that's going to be really interesting, because it's I think he ends up staying in Philly, and then he's a free agent after next year, which maybe is even more interesting. But you know, it was two spectacular games for Foles after what was a pretty middling,
Yeah,
you want to be generous, you can call him a high-end backup type of career. It's like you look at Foles, the reason he was in Philly, the reason the Eagles brought him back was because, you know, he was an Andy Reid guy, and he knew the system with, that they could plug him in pretty easily with Doug Peterson's system. And if it weren't for that, you'd kind of wonder if, I mean, would he have been signed anywhere this past offseason if the Eagles didn't happen to be in need of a quarterback, a backup quarterback, I should say?
So. Someone probably would have taken him, but I get what you're saying. And Nick Foles was an Eagle because he played for Doug Peterson in Kansas City. And this is the discussion we've had that stems from the Kaepernick debate, Gary, is what kind of backup quarterback do you want? And they wanted one that could just continue their system rather than if you take the Kaepernick type or an electrifying, unique quarterback, you have one that redefines your system when he comes off the bench. And their preference was to continue the system, and it worked out very well for them.
All right, this next question is Stuart via Facebook. Andy always mentions how guys in the NBA are in the NFL. I said NBA accidentally. He wrote NFL.
Yeah, what was that?
NFL.
How did that happen?
I don't know. Well, trade deadline happened recently, so maybe NBA is still on my mind here. Andy always mentions how the guys in the NFL are the top 0.1% of players in the sport. So I was wondering specifically at the quarterback position, as it's probably easiest to explain, use another position if I'm wrong, how much does the situation determine a player's future in the game? Obviously, player motivation and learning habits are a big factor, but I'm thinking if they are similar and we focus on coaching, offensive line, receiving talent around the player, if David Carr had his brother's situation, would he have been far better? Where could Ryan Tannehill be if he had the Dallas offensive line and run game with him? Yeah, I mean, it's a good question, and it kind of, to me, it kind of ties back to what we just talked about two questions ago with Wentz. It's, you know, you have to find the right marriage between the quarterback and the system, and then obviously you want the supporting cast in place. But, yeah, I mean, I'm sure you could go back. You could find a lot of guys who probably would have been a lot better. I mean, Jared Goff is kind of the obvious example right now. You know, if Goff didn't have McVay this year, would he have become what Goff has become? And on top of that, you know, if Goff was merging with McVay at like age 32 or something, could he have sort of recalibrated his career at this point?
Well, what we have here, this question basically amounts to what is the meaning of life? And if you try to answer it on a macro level and answer the whole question, you've got no chance. It's too big and it doesn't work. So it becomes a series of micro questions, and this is what teams deal with all the time. It's like you bring up examples, and yeah, Tannehill offensive line, if he has Dallas's offensive line, what is he now? That's the kind of question every team asks when they're evaluating free agents, when they're evaluating rookies, is how do they fit with what we have around them? How would they fit with what we do? And it varies guy to guy. I mean, that's basically just the question says evaluate every player in every circumstance. And it's a smart question, but it's not one that you can just answer. That's the process of football. That question gets answered again and again and again and again as you build teams.
Yeah. No, I think the one thing it ties into is, you know, we're aggressive in labeling guys busts, especially when it comes to quarterbacks, because that is, you know, that's a sort of high importance position, and it's one that often depends on what the system is, what the supporting cast is. You know, we're quick to label guys busts, but, you know, was it the draft pick? You know, you got to get the draft pick and then you got to develop him. And some teams do that better than others.
Absolutely. And it gets down to assistant coaching is a big factor there. Those are the guys who are working directly with the players. And then whoever's designing the offense, I'm more convinced than ever that coordinators are huge people within the NFL, huge factors. It's all of that stuff. It's a hard one to deal with there.
All right, Andy. You know, before we move
Gary,
on,
one more thing. You could argue, based on those questions, you could argue that the real superstars are the players who transcend that question. Where, in other words, you say the answer is, well, who do we want around them? Who's in this? It doesn't matter. Aaron Rodgers, he's great wherever you put him. J.J. Watt, when he's healthy, he's great no matter what the system. You could argue that that's the litmus test for superstars, is can we answer, while it doesn't really matter with that guy, on a question like this one?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think Rodgers is the only guy you'd put in that category. Possibly even Tom Brady. I mean, look, Tom Brady was a 6th-round pick for a reason. And, you know, if he landed in, I won't pick on any specific franchise, but if he landed with another franchise, what would he be right now? Maybe not Tom Brady.
Yeah. Oh, and see, and he's so good at what he does that you couldn't help but build your system around him. So who's a team that runs play action with the QB outside the pocket? You know, Rick Dennison's not in Buffalo anymore, but let's say it's Buffalo's system. Brady would not be very good in Buffalo's system if they played strictly to that. So there are also guys who transcend the question in the sense that stuff takes the shape of them. They're the container that holds the liquid, and everything around them takes on their shape. That's another way to look at it for who are the real superstars, and there are not very many guys like that, and especially at the non-quarterback positions. There might be 10 to 12.
Absolutely. Andy, before we move on, you know, we all live busy lives, and unfortunately there's not enough hours in the day to get everything done. So thank goodness there's Freshly, the easiest and most convenient way to eat healthy no matter what life throws your way. Freshly's team of chefs create all-natural, gluten-free dinners and deliver them fresh to your door. So even if you get stuck at work late, you can still come home to a delicious dinner cooked by a chef. No more worrying about having to figure out what's for dinner, and especially no mess to clean up after. I tried the chicken parm the other day for the first time. It was absolutely tremendous. All their stuff is great, but it's almost like every time you pick one, you find a new winner there. Their menu is created by chefs for people who want to eat healthy but are living busy lives and don't always have the time to shop, cook, or clean. The best part about Freshly is the number of comfort meals they currently have that are also super healthy, like the buffalo chicken with loaded cauliflower, one of my favorites. Customize your weekly meals from their constantly changing, rotating menu of more than 30 chef-crafted options. There's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want them. Every single meal comes with a detailed and easy-to-read overview of each ingredient featured in the meal. Trust me, there's nothing better than knowing that no matter what happens in my daily life, that I have a chef-cooked dinner waiting for me at home. Check out this week's menu created by Freshly's chefs and get $25 off your first order of six chef-cooked dinners plus free shipping by going to freshly.com/10things. That's 10things. You'll feel so relieved to come home to a chef-cooked meal every night with Freshly. That's freshly.com/10things, 10things, for $25 off your first order. Order today to see what life's like when you no longer have to think about dinner. All right, jumping back into the mailbag here. This is from Twitter, at 801loaf, who, by the way, was the smart gentleman or lady who suggested we put our social media in the episode details. So that'll be easier to find and get in touch with us and all that stuff. But at 801loaf asks, I know quarterback is the most important, but who was the best at their position in 2017? Like, did Justin Tucker kick better than anyone did anything, or did Zach Martin run slash pass block better than anyone did anything? That's a good question for you, Andy. Who was the biggest gap between a number one and a number two at a position this year?
Off the top of my head, my answer is Antonio Brown at wide receiver. That's without having dived very deep into this, though.
Who would you, if you were looking forward, would your answer change? Like, who would you, if you were ranking, looking forward to 2018?
Yeah, that's a hard one. That's a hard one because of how many. Luke, maybe say Luke Kuechly, a middle linebacker. I think the gap between him and number two is pretty substantial, and I probably have Bobby Wagner or Sean Lee at number two. And Sean Lee, you know, hasn't been a true middle linebacker all the time, but let's call them stack backers. Kuechly, I think Brown, you still have to say, at some point, Antonio Brown, you figure, will come back down to earth or somebody else will elevate. And I could be wrong on Brown, too. I mean, Julio Jones is a great player. I had Adam Thielen as my other all-pro vote this year. I don't think Thielen's quite in Brown's orbit. Mm-hmm. Do you have a good answer to this one, Gary?
I don't. I'll say Justin Tucker because it was suggested. But you know what was really what I loved about Antonio Brown in that playoff game against the Jaguars, where he was clearly not moving at 100%, is it was kind of a reminder of how good he is sort of around the ball. I don't know if you call that sort of at the moment of the catch, at the catch point there, where those subtle little shoves, he gets away with them. And I know part of it is because he's a superstar, and maybe if he was an unknown rookie, he'd get flagged every once in a while. But he's so good at creating that like last second separation to make a catch, and that stood out so much in that Jaguars game, where he was really unable to create any separation in that game, but he was still making plays.
Yeah, he is. Yeah, that's a great way to put it. And then his, when he is healthy, and his quickness and transitional skills are off the charts. To give this question some kind of perspective, because I was hoping for a few guys like this when I filled out my All-Pro ballot this year. It took me about 18 hours, I want to say, to 16, 18 hours to fill out that whole thing, because I went through and read the film notes on any guy who I thought might be a contender. So there was nobody that made it quick there. Every single guy took a lot of time to think, because there are good players at the top of the NFL. No position had a clear, isolated, far and away superstar compared to everybody else, other than quarterback. Actually, quarterback was the one, because Wentz was out.
Yep. Let's go. Let's see. Dan Jacobson via Twitter. I'm a Patriots fan. I see the Pats often put players in motion. Anecdotally, it seems we use this more than our opponents do. Why would teams choose not to use motion? That's a good question, Andy. We've talked, you know, we talk a lot about the advantages of putting guys in motion. Why would a team opt not to do that?
This is funny timing, because I promise you, just yesterday, and I don't know where this came from or why it happened, as I was stepping into the shower, I thought this exact same question. I hadn't even been thinking football stuff all day. Yep. It just came to me. I thought, why doesn't everybody use motion on every snap? What's the downside of it? And I'm in the early parts of that exploration. Then here we go. We get this question here right now. This is something I'll be asking coaches around the combine in a few weeks, because there are answers to it. I mean, some that I can think of, one reason you wouldn't use motion is if you want to play up tempo, you want to play faster. You're not going to use motion then. Another reason is it does add more on the plate of the players who have to execute it. Guy, where a receiver lines up, his split, in other words, is very critical. And if he's 4 yards outside and he lines up 4.5 yards, that's wrong, and that's going to have a consequence. And that, a lot of the times when I'm watching film with coaches and it's offensive, and I say, well, what went wrong on this pass play? He says, well, so-and-so wide receiver, he was lined up too far out in the split or too tight, and that messed up the spacing and the timing. It's very subtle, and there's almost no way to tell unless you know the exact design. So when you add motion into that equation, you're going to get a higher margin of error on that kind of thing. It makes life easier on the quarterback because the motion gives information from the defense about what they're playing, but it gives your receivers and your skill players, your backs, your tight ends, gives all those guys a little bit more to deal with. And then the last one I can think of is some QBs prefer a still picture. Like Peyton Manning, for a lot of years, the Colts never used motion in all those years. They just lined everyone up in the same spot every single snap, and Peyton Manning went through and researched the nuances of the defense. He was probably studying the body language of individual players rather than just what coverage are they in. They were looking for different cues. They processed the game differently. So that could be another reason you wouldn't use motion. But the question in theory, I'm always a fan of, why don't you do this on every play when we're talking scheme and tactics? Because that's what gets you to the nuts and bolts of everything. That's a good question to ask, is why don't you use motion? What are the downsides of motion besides the three things we just went through?
That was a really good answer, Andy. That was much better than I thought you'd come up with.
The same here. As I started talking, I started thinking of more stuff. I'm still going to go around and ask guys at the combine, because the premise is really good. I think I'm a big fan of schemed offenses and changing guys' location and getting information to the quarterback. I often wonder why teams don't do that more often, even if it's just smoke and mirrors. You can line up a guy. The Chargers do it all the time. They put their running back out way wide and start out in empty and then bring the running back into the formation, and he goes to his usual spot, and now they're in a regular formation. But the defense has shown some information in the process of that. So we'll see. And by the way, Gary, and this is something to keep in mind. I touched on this a little bit from the Super Bowl film study article I did. Defenses are starting to catch on to this, and they're not given the same information that they used to. A lot of teams are showing man coverage when they're playing zone, and they're giving false looks when these teams line up guys and put them in motion. It's just something to watch, because if that trend continues, safeties and linebackers, especially safeties, are going to become a lot more valuable, because they're going to have to start doing cornerback things in order to disguise the coverages. The Falcons did it with Keanu Neal at times this year. The Eagles and the Patriots both did it in the Super Bowl this season. Just something to keep in mind is that defenses will have an answer for this with offenses motioning and moving guys around so much. They're going to find a way to stop giving their defensive information away on it.
Yeah, I mean, you had mentioned that in your Super Bowl deep dive piece. The Eagles were basically running a linebacker out to cover. I can't believe I'm forgetting the Patriots fullback's name. Who's the Patriots fullback?
Oh, James Devlin. Yeah.
They're running a linebacker on it, playing man there, and then playing zone everywhere else.
Yeah, and that's called a boundary lock. When you put someone out wide, whoever's got the guy closest to the sideline, he just plays man-to-man on him, and the sideline helps him a lot, helps the defender, and then you play your regular coverage inside of that, the other 10 defenders. And you can do that, like the Eagles did, where you just put Michael Kendricks out on the fullback, and we're not going to let the fullback, because the whole reason Devlin's out there is just to remove your cornerback from the equation. They don't plan on throwing Devlin the ball, but they know with the Eagles and how they line up, if we can get him wide, we might get Jalen Mills or Ronald Darby to have to cover him, and now that takes away one of their best cornerbacks. So the Eagles weren't going to let the Patriots do that, and you can do it that way. The other thing is when you have a superstar corner, like the Cardinals do this with Patrick Peterson, you can just have him play boundary lock all game long and then play a litany of different coverages inside. My guess is that I didn't watch film when I was 8, and I wouldn't have known what I was looking at, but my guess is the Cowboys used to do that with Deion Sanders as well. So there are different ways to play all this stuff. What this amounts to, we're talking hybrid coverages now, and how can you get into your hybrid coverages? And it sounds like really there are two approaches. You can have versatile safeties, maybe some versatile linebackers, or you can have a shutdown corner who can play ISO man somewhere within the equation. That's the chess match right here, going back and forth. And offenses are ahead of defenses right now with this pre-snap motion stuff. And where defenses are ahead is with their pass rush designs and forcing offenses to block who the defense wants. And that's football. You make them react to what you do in a way they don't want to have to react.
All right. Rodrigo via TalkBack writes in, speaking of defensive backs here, given the skill set of Malcolm Butler being a smaller and quicker guy, does this mean teams running zone-based coverages are totally going to dismiss him in free agency, and where do you see him playing next year?
I don't know where he'll play. I don't think this dismisses him in free agency, though. Antoine Winfield was a great zone defender for a lot of zone teams over the years. He's one of the smaller corners to ever play. I know he moved into the slot in passing situations. This guy was around Buffalo Bills and Minnesota Vikings about 8 years ago. Does that sound right to you, Gary?
I feel like it's more than 8 years, but...
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
But so I don't think Butler is a true just pure man-to-man corner. I think he would work in a number of different schemes. I think he's fine. I think he's going to get a good contract offer, assuming what happened in the Super Bowl, whatever it was, doesn't hinder him, and it very well could hinder him.
Now, you're right, Andy. 2010, he was a Pro Bowler, Antoine Winfield. You're also right about the Malcolm Butler thing, but yeah, Antoine Winfield, 2008 through 2010, was a Pro Bowler. Started his career in 99. He had a really long career. He had a Terrence Newman type of length to his career here.
Yeah, boy. And then what years did he make the Pro Bowl?
2008-2010 were his only
he started in 99 and then became a three-time Pro Bowler 10 years into his career at a position where age usually declines you quickly, cornerback.
Yeah. Yep. Those were his latter Vikings years.
So what we need to do is ask the next nut job that wants to look into this for us, what other guys have become multi-time Pro Bowlers after playing 10 or more seasons? So in year number 10 or 11 or 12, who are the end-of-the-year stars? I wonder who else has done that, and what are the common factors with them? Winfield, my guess is playing in a zone scheme was a big reason why. When you can't run as well, let's assume at his 11th year he didn't run as well as he did in his first or second year, that's when you become a zone defender. And playing zone defense helps you, and he was very good at that. And he was a small guy. So if Malcolm Butler can do that, I think he would. He's pretty physical. I think he'd be a decent cover two corner if you want to play that way. And remember, nobody plays cover two on every snap anyway, so you still have to be able to play man-to-man and carry receivers deep. But, nut jobs out there. Give us the Antoine Winfield, all Antoine Winfield team. Who are some other guys like that?
Yeah,
and
guys,
then we'll try to remember to acknowledge you next week.
Guys who have played 10 years and made multiple Pro Bowls after the 10th year of their career.
Yeah, but no Pro Bowls before that. So
no
guys that became stars at the end, like Rich Gannon, to me, I bet he's one of them off the top of my head.
Yeah.
Guys like that. Who are the Rich Gannon and Antoine Winfields out there?
Yeah, so Winfield made Pro Bowl in years 10, 11, and 12 of his career.
Incredible.
Pretty good. Let's see, next question. Anthony from Ireland via TalkBack. It seems like an unusually fluid quarterback market this offseason, but there's relatively little discussion about Jacoby Brissett. What is your evaluation of his year with the Colts? Do you think he will stay there as a backup, or would he be a good fit as a starter elsewhere. And Andy, I know you're not going to like this, but I'm going to pull the curtain back real quick. We haven't talked about the Colts coaching situation because we think by the time you hear this, you might know something we do not know. So we know McDaniels
you being
is
the
out.
Listeners.
We don't know who the next head coach of the Colts is going to be, but McDaniels backing out brought a whole new round of speculation about Andrew Luck's shoulder up, and it's all speculation at this point. We don't know. Nobody knows. He's not throwing yet, but certainly he has plenty of time to get back on the field. But I think because of Luck's shoulder, I don't think there's any way Brissett's going anywhere else this offseason.
So let's just keep the conversation focused on Brissett, because you're right. We don't know all the other external factors, big ones, quarterback's health, who's coaching, what are they doing. I think there's a sleeping giant there in Indianapolis. I like Brissett a lot. In fact, I tweeted, and this was before Garoppolo actually stepped on the field and started playing, but it was more just a tweet about Brissett. At one point in the season, I tweeted that we might look back in 5 years and realize Jacoby Brissett was the second-best player on the Patriots roster, second-best QB on the roster entering training camp, not Garoppolo, because I think Brissett's got the tools to be a quality NFL starter. Now, the tools, it's one thing to have the tools. You still have to build with them and build something, and his accuracy needs to be a little more consistent. He didn't read the field with great consistency last season, but remember, he stepped in on an offense he didn't know anything about midway through the season and just started playing. So he hasn't even practiced what he's been playing in. That will change now. I think skill set wise, Jacoby Brissett has the chance to be a big time NFL quarterback, and I would be excited if you told me he's the guy I have to build with. Now, am I excited enough to go out and give up a first round pick for him right now? Not an early one, probably, maybe a mid or late first round pick, but let's just scale it back. The premise is I think Brissett can be a real quality NFL starter. And how does that factor into what the Colts do with him or with Andrew Luck if we don't know where his health is?
Yeah, and Brissett made his first start 15 days after being traded to the Colts, so that's a pretty impressive turnaround right there. We'll see. He's going to be a good one. Two more years on that rookie contract. So, but yeah, I think the Colts end up hanging on to him for as long as they can. Let's see, next one is via Twitter. This is from Lax. If given truth serum, would the Rams redo giving up 2 1s, 2 2s, and 2 3s for Goff and change? And would you guys do that knowing you would have McVay orchestrating the offense? I'm assuming Lax is implying if you knew McVay was coming in and you could basically he was going to upgrade your quarterback no matter who it is, would you still be that aggressive in coming up to get Goff? Andy, I'll let you take this one first.
Well, if I knew McVay was coming in and I knew Kirk Cousins would be a free agent entering McVay's second season, I probably don't trade for Goff because I'm sure Cousins would love to follow McVay to Los Angeles. But that's a lot of things to know out in the future, and there's no way for the Rams to have known any of that. So I believe it's hard to overpay for a franchise quarterback. Now, is Goff a franchise QB? That's still to be determined, but I'm sure the Rams, with the truth serum, they would tell you, we really like how Goff fits what McVay does, and we really believe McVay is going to be our guy for the big-time foreseeable future, so we're comfortable with where we are and everything.
All right. Yeah, well,
go ahead, Gary. Sorry.
No, I was going to say, if you gave him the truth serum, I think the question you'd ask, would they have taken Wentz instead of Goff 2 years ago? I think they'd have to say yes to that. But I don't think there's a price too high for finding your quarterback. It's so hard to find the quarterback and then find the quarterback coach pairing that works. I think it was draft capital well spent by the Rams.
Yeah, I agree. And the question, the premise of the whole question, and the Rams don't like this, and I know McVay does not like this, but the premise is basically McVay's system is so good it's making guys into stars, and so are the guys worth investing huge money in? That's what I've been saying about kind of Todd Gurley a little bit, and they're now applying it to Goff, and that might follow the Rams. It's not a big deal, though. This just, as long as the locker room stays fine and McVay makes the point, hey, you guys are making the plays, I'm not the one making the plays, which is what he's saying to those guys, everything's fine. But the Rams are not thrilled with how the perception is that McVay's doing all the work and these guys are just reaping the benefits, because they don't feel that way.
Yeah. Next question. This is Aaron via TalkBack. Did Jimmy Haslam give up on Sashi Brown and the Moneyball team right before they were about to reap the rewards of their plan? I mean, I do believe that John Dorsey is a better personnel evaluator, but everybody in Northeast Ohio knew that this was part of the process, parenthetical, losing badly for a few seasons, then drafting well. Sometimes I think that NFL owners are really bad fantasy football owners that happen to own a real team. That last sentence is often true.
It is true. I think it's true in this case.
Yes. Yeah, the Sashi Brown legacy is going to be really interesting, because I'm going to talk NBA again for a second. The obvious parallel is Sam Hickey in Philadelphia, and Sam Hickey, his big thing was, oh, you got to get assets, you got to, we're going to get superstars, we're going to turn these assets into superstars and all that, and we're going to lose, but we're going to get high draft picks. That's how you build a winner in the NBA. Sam Hinkie happened to be just a historically bad drafter. So it's almost like, okay, well, you have all these chances, but unless second coming of LeBron James is coming out, you keep on swinging and missing on all these picks. And, whatever, they have a good young nucleus there now, and everyone's happy about Sam Hinkie, even though they could have been, if they had a better drafter, they could have been probably, a championship contender at this point. Yeah. As far as the Browns go, it's kind of the same thing. I mean, it's not a new idea. This is what, half the teams in the league have done this for years. This is a Belichick thing. This is a Jimmy Johnson thing, collecting draft picks, collecting as many draft picks as possible. The Browns have been bad, so on top of that, they've been picking high. I tend to think people are overrating their young talent a little bit. They have Myles Garrett. Myles Garrett's great. He was also the number one overall pick, so I don't know how much you want to say, what a great job by the front office getting Myles Garrett. He was first overall. You could have had anyone. So you better get a good guy there. But I don't know if they have a collection of young talent that's so exceptional that you just say, wow, they needed more time here. I think they might have tripped and fallen. Jimmy Haslam might have accidentally tripped and fallen into a good situation where now he has sort of a more traditional talent evaluator to go out and use these assets that have been collected. I'm not I think John Dorsey's fine. I don't think he's a spectacular track record of drafting or anything like that. But I think I'd feel better about him running the show than the combination of Hugh Jackson and the sort of the analytics guys teaming up.
Well, what we never figured out was what were the analytics doing? Were they deciding how we use cap space and acquire picks, or were they deciding how we evaluate players? And those are two gargantuanly different things. And we never quite figured that out. The other thing, and the answer to the question, by the way, did they give up too early? Yes, because when we saw this move made and we said, okay, that's the path they're going down, this is a five-year path, and you probably can evaluate it after year three or four if you want to get antsy. And here they are making the change after 2 years. What did they think? Well, we didn't win any games. Well, what did you think you were going to win? Well, probably three or four games. So, it was mild disappointment that came off just really badly because the record's so atrocious. I don't buy the narrative that this team was just a group of awful players. I didn't see that at all on film. I think this is a 5-11 type of roster right now, and it just wasn't well orchestrated a year ago. So I don't think the Sashi Brown era was as bad as it might go down in history. And if things turn around, it's going to look like John Dorsey saved the day. And maybe John Dorsey does make some good moves. He's got a lot of ammunition to work with, cap room and draft picks. But the Browns, let's remember, in my opinion, and I'd say even a fervent opinion at this point, the Browns this season were never as bad as their record indicated.
Yes, I'll agree with that. But I think people get sort of carried away with, look at all this young talent. And it's good young talent. It's a good young roster. But look, they haven't done a great job of player development, and that might be coaching staff more so than front office at this point. But I was hearing from people saying, "Oh, but they got Corey Coleman and Sean Coleman." It's like, okay, those are kind of promising young players, but they're certainly not guys. You know, Corey Coleman was a mid first round pick. I don't know if you're necessarily satisfied with the returns on that at this point, even though he might be good in the long run. I think people get carried away a little bit with potential, and then on top of that, you basically grouped all this potential together, and it's almost like there's nothing, whether it's the quarterback situation or maybe just a lack of veterans. It's just there's it's not being held together properly. You just sort of threw out a bunch of talented young guys, and we're kind of like, all right, figure it out. And again, maybe that's
by the way, Gary.
Staff,
that's called team building. That's team building. I mean, that's you're describing a work in progress. This is how rosters come to be. What else were they going to do? I mean, they do have some talented young guys. You got to play with them. You have to get experience, and it takes time for that to manifest.
But you go 0-16 because you basically. You don't have the type of roster that can compete at the moment, and I think that's problematic for the long term. You got to learn how to win at some point. And I don't know if you can learn how to win.
No, sure, I get that, but my argument is they did have the roster that could compete. They just that roster didn't happen to win any games, and I think there wasn't – I mean, I'll just come out and say it. I hate to say it this way. I don't think they were very well coached this year.
I think we're just gonna have to agree to disagree on this, Andy. I don't. Yeah, you collect young talent, but I think you have to have more. You have to have some sort of plan in place to how you're gonna develop these guys. And again, it's the coaching too. But you're slapping all these 22 and 23 year old guys on the field and saying go win games and they're not ready for it. And I think losing just begets more losing. I mean, we talk all the time about how the talent level, it's such a razor thin margin between the best and the worst. I mean, these are the, like Andy Benoit says, the top 0.1%. I think when you never learn, I think back to the Packers loss where they figured out a way to lose that game to Brett Hundley at home. With a big lead in the fourth quarter. I mean, that's the kind of thing. You don't learn how to close games. You don't have the opportunity to close games. I think you have to have some semblance of for lack of a better phrase, like adults in the room to sort of get the right culture in place, I guess you'd call it.
I get that, but then who's the adult in the room? I mean, it's not like they have all rookies out there. They have veteran guys at different spots. They signed some free agents. They signed Jamie Collins. I know he was hurt down the stretch, but they signed Collins. You know, they signed Zeitler from Cincinnati. I mean, they had some veteran pieces in place. I don't know. Let's ask this, Gary. How many, if the season starts tomorrow, how many wins do you think the Browns get if the season started tomorrow?
I'd put over under the same quarterback situation. We're saying like no changes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Put over under at 1.5.
Really? Oh,
yeah.
Yeah, you're right. We do have to agree to disagree. So I put the over under at about 4.5. Again, we're both. Let's also remember we're describing a last place team, no matter which way we slice it up. So also, yes. Both of these teams have work to do, and I think we can agree to agree on that one. I'll be real interested to see what happens with the Browns because since Jimmy Haslam has come in, they have almost every single time done the exact opposite of what I thought they were going to do with major decisions. Who's the coach? Who's the quarterback? Who are we retaining? What are we doing? It's they've gone the exact opposite direction with everything every single time, the whole George Costanza approach. And they did it again this offseason. I thought they'd fire Hugh Jackson. They didn't, and they decided to overhaul the front office. We'll see. We'll see what happens.
All right. Andy, so back to Mattress Firm. Let's keep the ball rolling, shall we? Everyone knows how important stretching is before an event. So does Mattress Firm. Except it's your dollar. Your budget stretches further when you're shopping at America's Neighborhood Mattress Store. It's a home run, and you'll have a ball. They're the head coaches when it comes to mattress expertise, but know this, they are more than mattress experts. They have a game plan that helps you transform your mattress into a bed, from adjustable bases and sheets to headboards and bedroom decor. They have you literally and figuratively covered up like your favorite cornerback. Go to mattressfirm.com/podcast to see what deals are happening as I read this sentence to you. They even offer you a 120-night sleep trial to ensure perfection and a 120-night low price guarantee, so you know you paid the perfect price. Talk about a 1-2 punch, a knockout, if you will. Score big with a perfect bed. Head to mattressfirm.com/podcast to get the play-by-play on how you can monumentally improve your sleep today, tonight, and tomorrow. All right, a couple more questions here. Sean via TalkBack. Do you think the NFL should or will go back to reviewing plays only when a coach throws a challenge flag instead of reviewing every scoring play and turnover? That would speed up the play of the game drastically. I don't think they're doing that. No. I do think you're going to see over the next 5 years, I think there's going to be some drastic changes to try and speed the game up. I know Peter King has been thrown around. I think Peter King has been thrown around. This maybe Andrew Brandt, one of the guys who's smarter than me, is throwing around the idea that incomplete pass, clock doesn't stop anymore. Just get the ball, spotted again, and move on.
So I hate that idea.
I do too, but I think you're going to see something. I wouldn't be surprised if I saw that. As far as reviews,
I'll tell you why that idea is not going to fly, though, is because I know the NFL's popularity has dipped the last year and a half, 2 years, mm-hmm. but let's also remember the 10 to 12 years before that, it soared. And a big reason it soared is because fantasy football became more popular. And what drives fantasy football are statistics. And statistics come from plays. The more plays you run, the more stats you get, the more entertaining and diverse your fantasy football league is. So if you run the clock, you're going to reduce the number of plays in a game drastically, and that's going to impact fantasy football. I think that would be totally misguided. What the NFL will do is find ways to cut out all the stuff that I fast forward, all the in-between time between kickoffs. Instant replay absolutely needs to get quicker. I don't think they reduce it in terms of what's challenged, but they need to find a way to streamline it. And at some point, these calls will probably just come directly from the league office rather than the ref doing the dog and pony show, watching it on the surface out there on the field.
I never understood the need for the theater of the instant replay review.
That used to be how they had to do it, or at least that's how they did it, was he went over and looked in the booth, and then it kind of changed, and then they realized, well, we can sell advertising with the surface coming out on the field and still maintain the – I get that. I understand it's a business too, and that's important. But the way to speed up the game is not to reduce the game, which running the clock would do. The way to speed up the game is to trim all the fat around. The game lasts 60 minutes of clock running time, and you've got most games taking about 3 hours and 5 minutes. So there's 2 hours and 5 minutes that you need to be trimming somewhere within. It's not the 60 minutes that you trim.
No, I agree with that. I think you're going to see changes. I wouldn't be surprised if they started running the clock, not in the last, you know, maybe you say like last 5 minutes of each half, it stops on incompletions. But I wouldn't be shocked if that happened. I think it would be a bad idea. I think you make a great point, Andy. But I wouldn't be surprised if we saw it happen.
Think of it. I mean, that would impact a lot of legacies too, because They would run so many fewer plays. It probably reduced the game by 15 plays a game, I want to guess. I mean, how many incomplete passes are there a game? So that would impact. I mean, guys, stats at the end of the season, 4,000-yard seasons in passing now take on a new meaning, 1,000 yards rushing take on. I think that would open a really messy box if they did it that way. Is that really gaining? Has that even been mentioned, or is that just an idea that's floated by outsiders? Like,
I think
like
Peter is
our guys
it
at
out.
SI.
I shouldn't put it just on Peter in case it wasn't actually him, but I think Peter's been throwing that out.
He ought to throw it out. I think it's a horrible idea.
Let's get a. I think we have
he's the best boss in the world, though. He's the best boss, and he knows more than everybody. There.
I will not co-sign with Andy on that, Peter. Because I like my job. I think we have time for two more questions here, Andy. Nick via TalkBack. A lot of young quarterbacks, Jameis Winston, Marcus Mariota, Dak Prescott, Derek Carr, appeared to have stepped back this year in their progress. Is that how you see it? And are their growing pains normal for young QBs, driven by circumstances or something more fundamental to be worried about? What do you think, Andy?
I think with Carr, it's just... I wouldn't worry too much with Carr because the skill set's tremendous and the physical ability is excellent, and his wide receivers were not very good this year. And their running game was not particularly helpful.
Yeah.
So I'd call that one circumstance. Prescott's a little bit of a different conversation. I think he can be your guy, and I think you can win meaningful stuff with him as your quarterback, but you have to have a certain type of team around him. And if the running game's not there, and he needs a good supporting cast. He's a complimentary QB who's going to play really well within a system, and a system that kind of plays to his skill set. He's not Derek Carr where you can do anything and everything around him. He has to have specifics. So that is a little more limited, and it's a harder thing to deal with. That's why I think Carr's a better player and a more valuable player than Prescott. But I would be, if I'm the Cowboys or Raiders, I'm not even looking at the panic button by any means, though, with either of these guys.
Yeah. I thought Derek Carr was going to be an MVP this year. I totally bought into the marriage with Todd Downing and they were going to streamline the playbook and all that. And
yeah, I did too. It did not work out. They'll try it again.
Last question. Mylan via Facebook. And again, we're probably going to do some mini mailbags going forward, so keep the questions coming. This is Mylan via Facebook. You guys talk about Case Keenum or Eli Manning as a possibility for the Broncos next year. I was actually thinking about Sam Bradford as another option, or do you think he has proven himself to be too injury-prone? Sam Bradford, that's another guy. Sam Bradford, I said it was a dark horse MVP candidate, and he was through 1 week of the season, so I'll pat myself on the back for that. But... he's fascinating because obviously if the guy could stay healthy, he'd be in for a monster contract right now. But, I mean, gosh, can you possibly bring him in knowing that it's almost like 0% chance you're going to get 16 games out of him?
Well, there's the answer right there then. No, you can't bring him in. If he can't play, then you can't, then you're not, why would you sign him? So, and I had this conversation with someone at the Super Bowl this past week saying, because we were talking, who do they re-sign if they're the Vikings? This person believed it's going to absolutely be Teddy Bridgewater. We both believed it probably should be Case Keenum. And I said, well, what about Bradford? He's the most talented guy of all those three. And he said Bradford didn't even stay on the field. He didn't even have a new injury this year. He just was hurt.
Yeah.
And I think that's the coup de grace for Bradford as certainly as a franchise guy or the guy you build around. He'll be on a roster somewhere, but no, you cannot sign him with your plans and your season contingent on him staying on the field because history says he won't, and that history builds on itself, by the way. The more that injuries you acquire, the likelier it is that you're not going to stay healthy when you get older.
I mean, how would you feel about it if this is the Broncos and Kirk Cousins has gone elsewhere, Case Keenum has gone elsewhere, and they decide, which they might have already decided, that they just don't want to bring in another young guy after going through Trevor Siemian and Paxton Lynch? Would you sign Bradford and just kind of be like, okay, this is what we're going to do, cross our fingers? I mean, they got 10 regular season starts out of Peyton Manning a couple years ago. And won the Super Bowl. I mean, would you roll the dice there in that scenario?
I might under those conditions because, and then Trevor Siemian's my backup, I guess. That's the plan.
Yeah, you probably still have Siemian and Lynch on the roster.
Yeah. I probably, well, what would be, let's ask it this way. What would be the better alternative? If you get, and I'm sure if they got in that scenario, they would try to, I would try to trade for someone first. I thought Eli would be traded to Denver. I don't believe that anymore. When I thought that at the time, that was before the Dave Gettleman move.
Yep.
But would they go out and try to trade for a quarterback? I mean, we just talked about Jacoby Brissett. If you're the Broncos, would you make a move for someone like that? And I don't know the answer. That's a hard. Broncos are in a really weird spot, aren't they? You know who knows this? Kirk Cousins people, I'm sure, are paying close attention to these conversations.
Yeah.
Denver is, you could argue, because of how good they are at all the other spots, Denver is in desperate need of a quarterback because they're one quarterback away, and probably in their minds, from being close to the level they were at 2 years ago.
Yeah. I mean, that window's going to close pretty soon. They pick fifth overall in the draft. So, you know, that's the range where you can get your quarterback. I don't know if they have the appetite for another young guy after what happened the last 2 years.
So I wonder if they would consider, and if they could find a team that would even consider this. Does anyone have an aging quarterback that they would trade? Because it's such a rich class of QBs. I don't think the Chargers are the answer to this, but let's just use them as the example. How old was Phillip Rivers? 36, 37, probably something like that.
Yeah.
Would the Chargers consider trading Phillip Rivers for the, let's say, the number 5 overall pick in a year where there are 4 or 5 first-round quality QBs, supposedly? Maybe you throw in a second-rounder and maybe you're an Emmanuel Sanders type or whatever, you know, something like that to sweeten it. Would a team that has one of those QBs consider doing that? Because I think that would be in Denver's best interest if this really is about winning Super Bowls. And maybe if they feel like Paxton Lynch, while he hasn't blossomed into what we hoped yet, we also didn't think he would blossom in 2 years, and we need to be a little more patient, and we're going to give it a shot. I don't know if they feel that way or not about Lynch, but which QB would even be in that criteria, and would a team ever pull the trigger on something like that?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, Chargers aren't going to deal
with
Rivers.
No, because Rivers hasn't slowed down. Yeah, Chargers have their own Super Bowl aspirations, too.
And not within the division on top of that. I mean, Andy Dalton, would you, and who knows what's going to happen with his contract at this point, but, I mean, would you
I don't think Denver would do that. I think it has to be, I think we need to go a class up. Joe Flacco, which some people might say is not a class up from Dalton anymore. I bet you Elway thinks he is, though. He remembers Flacco coming into Mile High and beating him in that 2012 playoff season. So would they theoretically trade for a Joe Flacco type of guy or someone a tick better than Flacco? And would that be in the interest of the Ravens or whoever has that QB?
Yeah. Going to be interesting. Lots of quarterbacks to talk about this. You know, not a great free agent class, but quarterbacks. So many quarterbacks. Maybe not all great quarterbacks, but a lot of them.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's two, right? Cousins and Keenum. Who else is a free agent at QB that's going to change things?
Lots coming out in the draft. And then you got, like we said, you got Bradford. You got, you got the bridge guys kicking around. Your Josh McCown, your Tyrod Taylor.
Yeah, no, and there's a domino effect with all of that stuff. There is a unique mix. I think the only guy that really moves the meter is Keenum potentially because Cousins, of course.
Yeah.
And by the way, I keep thinking of more things to say, Gary. Kirk Cousins, he's going to be the most overrated player in the NFL by the end of this offseason because he'll have been talked about so much more than everyone else. And every time we talk about guys a lot, we naturally think they're better than they are. Remember, if Kirk Cousins on most people's lists, he's somewhere between 12 and 18 on quarterback rankings. And there's been years where I've had him in the low 20s, high 20s, 21 to 25 or so.
Mm-hmm.
So let's not also lose our minds and think that Aaron Rodgers is looking for a new team here.
That's a very sour note to end the show on, Andy.
Yeah, and especially because you were trying to promote off-season. Yeah, you were trying to promote our off-season stuff, too, and I just said there's nothing to really listen for. But
we'll listen.
If you're listening to the show, if they're this late in the show, we've got them. They're hooked. We've got these listeners. We don't need to impress these guys.
All right. Well, like I said a couple times during this episode, we're going to have some mini mailbags coming up, I'm sure, because at some point this news cycle has to slow down. So keep sending those questions, gramling_si, Andy_Benoit on Twitter. We're both on Facebook, or you can do talkback@themqb.com. All that information is in the episode description. If you want to see it there, copy and paste it. Make your life easier. But for now, thanks as always to producers Shelby Royston and Lou Pellegrino, as well as editor Chris Basil, the guys at Cadence 13, making us sound so good. But most of all, thank you to you guys for listening to this episode of the MMQB 10 Things podcast. You guys really are the best. Remember to listen and subscribe to new and archived episodes of the MMQB podcast with Albert Breer, the MMQB podcast with Peter King, and this show, the MMQB 10 Things podcast, wherever you listen to podcasts, including the MMQB.com, SI.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, and other podcast providers. We will see you guys next week. As regulation has officially expired on our podcast and there's no overtime in sight, I'll spare you the agony of more sports jokes. However, nothing hits the spot like some shut-eye after playing or attending a sporting event, and we think the same goes for listening to us talk about it. So let Mattress Firm help you drift off to dreamland. Simply put, your budget stretches further at Mattress Firm. Head to mattressfirm.com/podcast to learn how you can turn your sleep into a true slam dunk. I'm sorry.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.